Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to Solutions Watch. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, coming to you in mid-January of 2025. And if you are watching this as it is being released, then you already know that, yes, this year started off with a bang, quite literally, with the Cybertruck explosion that I reported on in last week's New World Next Week. Your exploding car is spying on you, where it was suddenly revealed, at least to the credulous public, that, oh yes, by the way, the Cybertruck and everything associated with the infrastructure supporting it is spying on you at all times, and can and will be accessed by the authorities as they deem fit. And it's not, of course, just Tesla. It is every major car maker these days is getting in on the act. And, well, as I promised in that New World Next Week, I thought the first Solutions Watch episode of the year should probably be on this subject of car freedom and privacy, because I know it is something that is near and dear to the hearts of many of my listeners. So, in order to talk about this, I'm going to bring in someone who actually knows what they're talking about. I'm not much of a gearhead myself, but let's bring in someone who is, specifically Eric Peters, who I note that his Mises Institute write-up says he is a freelance anarcho-libertarian writer who uses cars and bikes as the vehicles for making the case for freedom and self-ownership. His books include Road Hogs and Automotive Atrocities. He's written for the Washington Times, Detroit News and Free Press, Investors Business Daily, The American Spectator, National Review, The Chicago Tribune, and Wall Street Journal, etc., etc. But more to the point, you can find him and his blog at epautos.com, Eric Peters Autos, which has the tagline Automobiles, Motorcycles, and Libertarian Politics. Together at last. All right, so let's bring him on without further ado. Eric, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
You know, I just like the idea of bringing in the freedom perspective in different ways from different angles. And I must admit, until I started hearing you on various podcasts, I don't think I would have ever thought about the libertarian angle to the auto industry. How and why did you get into this? What is your background? How did you get started on this?
Well, I started out as a car journalist, but inevitably, there was some overlap with politics and being a libertarian. The things just kind of meshed together. And if you think about it, even for a little while, it's kind of obvious because cars ultimately are about mobility, the ability to get around, and specifically to get around on your own timetable, to not be under the thumb or under the control of the government, let's say, and forced to wait in line for the bus or the train. So in a very real sense, cars are, I think, inextricably linked with freedom. You can't have one without the other. I think it's a characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian societies that you're not allowed to move on your own initiative. You move when they tell you to move. So that's how I kind of got into writing about both of those things together.
You know, it's funny because I am just having a flashback to my very early childhood. I must have been 7 or 8 years old, and Alberta, where I'm from in Canada, became the last province in the country to institute mandatory seatbelt laws. And I remember seeing the news piece on that in the 6 o'clock news that evening, where they were interviewing people who were just irate and livid about this. Oh my God, government can't tell me to wear a seatbelt. They were literally cutting the seatbelts out of their cars to protest the law, etc. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm thinking about it, yeah, perhaps that was my introduction to libertarian mindset and politics, was through the car.
Yeah, sure. It seems like a petty thing, but you know, I've always said that principles and precedents matter, because once you accept one thing, it leads to the next thing. And when seatbelts were first mandated back in the 60s, well, they were mandated to be in new cars, not to be worn, but to be in cars. And then, of course, inevitably, the next step became you had to wear them. And having accepted that, then the next thing became, well, now you got to have airbags. And now we're at the point where the typical new car has at least 6 airbags, and it's several thousand dollars more expensive than it would be if it didn't have to have those things. And I'm not taking issue with whether seatbelts are effective and reduce the risk of being killed or severely hurt. That's not the point. My issue with it is that the government isn't my parent. I'm a grown man, you're a grown man, and we have the right to make risk-reward benefits for ourselves. And I think that if people want to buy and wear seatbelts or have airbags, they should have every right to have those things if they want them. But by the same token, if you don't, you have the same right to not have them and be made to pay for them. That's my position on the issue.
All right, let's start getting into this topic with some feedback that I've had from some of my listeners who, I know a lot of people are thinking about this. For example, I got an email recently from Kurt who's writing about my 2003 car engine has failed at last and there are no replacements. Mm-hmm. I cannot afford a classic car as they get more and more expensive, so I'm going to have to buy a car that spies on me, that nags me, that has tons of cruft to break and repair that I am not allowed to turn off or remove. There are so many reasons to look forward to the complete collapse of civilization. It seems the only way the tyrants can ever be stopped, which is a pretty bleak view, but it's what people get to. I had another comment from a listener, Faulty Towers, who wrote about vehicle data recording that's standard on most vehicles these days. He was citing off the list of things that the vehicle records about you as you're moving about. Of course, engine speed, accelerator status, brake status, vehicle speed, operation status of the driving assist systems, images from the camera. Your vehicle is equipped with cameras. Contact your dealer for the location of recording cameras, and oh yeah, that your vehicle may transmit the data recorded in these computers to our company without notification to you. And then I had a comment from Rex Leonum. Not long ago, I was in the market for a new car, and doing my due diligence, I test drove every car that tickled my fancy. One thing I noticed, the more expensive a car got, the less of a driving experience I got. I was looking at sporty cars, yet even here, they were selling ease of driving, not the thrill of driving. The car I initially thought I was going to end up with was a white Lexus IS350. Very nice looking car, sounded good, but noticed right away how everything was electric. Nothing was mechanical, like driving using my PC. The kicker was when the salesman who was in the back seat said that at the end of each trip, your car will tell you how well you drove. I shot back, for a car that costs this much, I will be grading its performance, not it mine.
Well, you'd like to think so. You know, these cars have become quite peremptorily parenting. You know, the assumption is that you're incompetent. The assumption is that you're reckless, that you're unable to drive. I'm amused by the term, which you hear a lot about lately, driver assistance technology. You know, that's in currency right now. And implicit in that is that you need assistance. And if you need assistance, perhaps you ought not to be driving. You know, perhaps why even have driver's licensing? Isn't the whole idea that it's sort of a metric of your competence to drive, that you pass some testing to show that you are minimally competent to safely operate a vehicle? And if you're not, well, maybe you should be a passenger and not a driver. So there's that. But to get to what you were talking about a moment ago, most people think that this is a relatively new phenomenon, this business of the cars keeping track of what you're doing behind the wheel. It's not. It goes back to the 90s. That was when they began to install something called EDRs, or event data recorders, in the vehicles. And they do keep telemetry records, kind of like, you remember, if you watched the movie Apollo 13 and, you know, the lunar capsule would send back data about what the space vehicle was doing. That's essentially what an EDR does. And the courts ruled, there was a case, I can't remember the case, but that that box can be taken out of your vehicle. And let's say there's an accident and the data is not yours, even though, you know, this is nominally your car, you paid for it, you know, and yet somehow the data that's in the car is not yours. Some external agency can access and take that data and use it against you. And then General Motors came up with OnStar also in the 90s, which was the first time in that mass-produced send and receive capability was put into a car, meaning that, you know, the car was connected to a GM OnStar center. And I remember one time I was driving a GM product, and I have a really great driving area that I like to test the new cars out on, called Bent Mountain. It's a series of tight switchbacks. And I was whipping up Bent Mountain, and as I exited one of the corners, all of a sudden a woman's voice erupted inside the car saying, "Do you need EMS?" And I, "What? What?" And as it turned out, the car thought that the G-forces that the car was experiencing indicated that it had left the road and had been wrecked. And that was sort of my awakening about the degree to which we're being monitored. And that was 30 years ago. So, you know, now literally everything that you do in the car is recorded and transmitted. I mean, to a micromanaging degree, the people who haven't been in a new car lately would probably not believe. But I assure you that it's true. A number of the new cars that I have test driven recently even have eye movement monitoring systems. They market this as drowsy driving. So, you know, you're sitting behind the wheel, and if you look closely at the dashboard, you'll see there's sort of like a little plastic box thing. And that's the infrared camera that's looking at your face and monitoring your eye movements. And if the computer thinks that you look to the left or to the right a little bit too long, it nags you. You know, look ahead, and bing, bing, bing. And, you know, leaving aside the parenting aspect of it, it's kind of enervating. It's to be constantly pestered by chimes and vibrating seats and vibrating steering wheels. It makes it really difficult sometimes to even concentrate on driving. So paradoxically, I think it makes vehicles less safe to operate than they would be if the driver were simply a good driver and paying attention to his driving.
Yeah, I had my own experience with that a few years ago. We were in the market for a new car, so we were test driving a bunch of stuff. Test drove one of the top of the line Toyotas, and yeah, it felt like I wasn't driving the car at this point with all the Toyota safety sense doodads and gadgets and radar assistance and all of this. It was horrible. And the guy that kept telling me, no, you don't have to touch the brakes. You don't have to do it. I'm like, I want to drive the car. Why are you telling me not to do this? It was horrible.
And by the way, there's an element of this too, that you have an illusion of driving in the sense that the physical control is illusory. You know, in the past, when you pushed on the gas pedal, you were actually causing a cable to move back and forth that went through the firewall that connected to the throttle, and that's what made the engine rev up and down. That's no longer the case. All cars now have something called drive-by-wire, which means that when you push on the gas pedal, all that's happening is that the deflection of that gas pedal is being registered by sensors, and then the sensors transmit data to the computer, and the computer then tells the engine to rev. And the transmission, when you put the automatic transmission from park into drive, it's not connected to anything. Simply a signal is being sent to the computer, and the computer is telling the transmission to go from park into drive. Now, what's really creepy is that since all of these things are electronic and since the cars are connected, these controls can be accessed externally. They can be made to work or to not work. And, you know, that's something that to me is quite bothersome. I don't like that idea at all.
You know, let's approach this from the economic perspective, first of all, because I think, yes, I understand why they would cater to people who aren't particularly good drivers or don't, you know, I get why there would be a market for that, but surely there is a market for people who like driving and like cars and like, for example, to be able to go under the hood and fix your own car without needing to be an electronics programmer. You know, it's ridiculous the extent to which they have undermined people's ability to essentially take control of their own driving experience. But I know there must be a market for this. So what is the skewed incentive here that is disincentivizing car makers to make cars for people who actually want cars?
I think it can be viewed as a form of rent seeking. And what do I mean by that? They've realized, the manufacturers, the car industry, that rather than fight the regulatory apparat, they've partnered with it because it means they can put all these things into all the cars and increase the price and make more money. Now, if they put it as an offer, let's say, and a good example of this is airbags. Airbags actually were first available in the early 70s. Both General Motors and Chrysler offered airbags, and you could buy them if you wanted on certain models. The problem was most people didn't want them, so most people didn't buy them. And so they scratched their heads and thought about it and realized, you know, if we could just get the government to pass a mandate, then we could make everybody have to buy airbags. And then there's an additional advantage. Because the car is more complex and because there are more regulatory rules that have to be complied with, it shuts out potential new entrants into the market because of the cost and the difficulty of developing all of these systems that are mandated by the regulatory apparat.
It's such there's so many different angles to this, but I think you've touched on an incredibly important one, the collusion between the big corporations and the government regulators who have their bread buttered on the same side. They both like the more control over the driving experience, and because, of course, it gives a profit to the automakers, and of course, it also infringes on liberties, which regulators always like to do. So this is Solutions Watch. I think people are probably fairly familiar with the problem. Let's talk about potential solutions. And I wanted to talk about an email that I just received from somebody on this very subject. He says, I am an air-cooled Volkswagen specialist. While I grew up in the USA, my friend and I currently share a garage in southern Italian-speaking Switzerland. We specialize in the legal modification and restoration of old VW bugs and buses. The Swiss authorities are a royal pain in the ass, but we manage to keep these old cars running and to make them safer and more fun to drive. Naturally, many documents are required, but perhaps in other countries like the USA, the laws are not so strict. Well, I don't know about that, but how about this as a first line of defense? How about just getting an old car, fixing it up yourself? Sure. How viable is that?
Well, it's very viable, especially if you're willing to learn how to do some basic mechanical things. And it's not difficult. You know, you and I are probably old enough to remember when, you know, most men knew how to do basic things like a brake job or a basic tune-up. It wasn't that hard. You know, if you were willing to read a basic repair manual and you've had a few basic hand tools, you could perform most of the necessary maintenance. And other than that, because these things were simple, they didn't really need a lot. I mean, they might have been a little bit more fussy. I've owned a number of old VWs, by the way. I used to drive a 74 Beetle in DC traffic back in the 90s. So it can be done. You know, you just have to be willing to learn a little bit about it. But that's the beauty of it, because you can. You really can't. You know, you have to be a technician. That's the term they use now, not mechanic. And you have to go to a specialized school. You have to have a lot of specialized equipment. I've got two buddies who are professional mechanics that both own their own shops. And it has gotten so elaborate, so complicated, and so expensive that they can't even service some of the brands because they'd have to buy, for example, my one buddy has stopped serving late model BMWs because he'd have to buy this proprietary BMW diagnostic computer in order to be able to correctly service the car. And it doesn't make sense for him. It doesn't pencil out because the cost of the equipment isn't going to be recouped by the repairs that he might perform on the vehicles. There's something else, though, that's really wonderful about these older cars, which is that they can be upgraded in a few critical ways to make them very much like modern cars in all the good ways. I have an old muscle car. I've got a 1976 Pontiac Trans Am. And when it was new, it did not come with an overdrive-equipped transmission. So it was kind of unpleasant to drive that car on the highway because of the mechanical gearing. You know, the engine would be spinning at a very high RPM at a comparatively low road speed, you know, around 65 miles an hour. You felt like the thing was coming apart because the engine was spinning so high. I installed a modern transmission in it, which is easy. It's a physical bolt-in to do that. And now I have overdrive gearing, and my car drives very much like a brand new car, not to mention even though it's 50 years old almost. You know, that sort of thing is very easy. These older cars are adaptable. They can be made much more drivable. Those old Beetles, you can put a little simple fuel injection system on them if you want. And so you never have to worry about fiddling with the carburetor. And that's it. Set and forget and drive. And you do it for substantially less money than it would cost you to buy one of these new vehicles.
What is the regulatory environment like in the U.S. with regards to the new safety standards that are coming in that might make that less of a viable option in the future?
Well, in the future, I'm sure that they're going to get progressively more stringent about what's allowable and not allowable. And heck, they already are. I'll give you a really good example of it, and I've written about this a couple of times. Toyota makes a vehicle called the Hilux Champ. This is a brand new vehicle, and it's basically a no-frills pickup truck. And there's nothing at all about it that's unsafe. It's, you know, it's a perfectly safe to drive car. However, it doesn't have six airbags. You can't pile drive it into a barrier and expect it to perform like a Mercedes S-Class, let's say. So, you know, they don't allow Toyota to sell that vehicle in the United States, which is just an atrocity. This thing costs $13,000. Can you imagine being able to buy a brand new basic truck for $13,000? You know, the least expensive trucks you can buy in this country are close to $30,000. So, you know, so there's that, but there are still some end runs. There's a pretty burgeoning market, and I think you'll appreciate this, that specializes in JDM vehicles, Japanese domestic market, right-hand drive vehicles. They get grandfathered in. And if you do a little Googling around, you can find companies that specialize in importing these things because they have a very restrictive, as you know, inspection procedure in Japan. And effectively, a car that doesn't pass the... What's the name of the inspection? Shaken, right?
Something like that.
And probably not asking correctly. Yeah. Shaken. Anyway, if the vehicle doesn't pass, effectively no vehicles that are over 5 years old, is my understanding, will pass shaken. So they get sent to other markets. There's nothing wrong with them. Well, they get imported here. And as long as they're, I think, pre-1996 or older, they get grandfathered in. They get exempt. So, you know, you could, for example, get vehicles that were never available in this market, like versions of the Toyota 4Runner that were available with diesel engines. They never sold those here. You can pick them up here. And you can pick them up for less than it would cost you to buy something like a new Tacoma with a turbo hybrid drivetrain that's probably not going to last, you know, more than 6 or 7 years before something expensive fails. I'd far rather have the old Hilux diesel. That thing's, there's a reason why all those jihadis drive those things, because they're indestructible. So those are two potential options, at least.
Excellent. All right. Okay, so that's a practical alternative, at least for now, at least until the regulators start licking their chops and outlawing gasoline engines and what have you. But
you know what? I draw a parallel here. You know, people who discuss this issue, and I'm one of the biggest discussers of the issue, all we have to do is not comply and say no.
Yes.
And if enough of us did that, this whole thing would lose its power. You know, during the beginning stages of the pandemic, I was one of those wrong thinkers who refused to put on the mask. And I kept saying, you know, if only enough of us would just refuse to do that, this nonsense would end. It would end very quickly. Unfortunately, most people, out of a sense of convenience, out of not wanting to make a fuss, wanting to go along to get along, they said yes, and they put the thing on, even if they knew it was silly, even if they knew it was tyrannical. The way you defeat tyranny is by standing up to it and just saying, no, I'm not doing it.
I agree. Although it didn't work out for the people that were cutting their seatbelts out in Alberta in the 1980s. So I don't know. But it is, I agree that noncompliance is going to be at some point an absolutely essential part of all of this. And on that note, I wanted to draw people's attention to a specific article on your site, Reader Question, A Way Out of This Mess, where you had a question in from Troy who said, recently I've been part of a community of almost 10,000 freedom-loving folks that stemmed from the Bitcoin community. They value independence, decentralization, and the ability to do it yourself. I've seen some of them say things like, we need an open source car. And he goes on to describe that and gives an example of what they're sort of working on. Basically, creating your own car in a sort of kit fashion. And if we could do this, then we could circumvent all these laws. Tell us about that idea, about what you've seen with regards to projects like this in the past and what your take on it is.
Yeah, that already exists in a number of ways. In most states, there are exemptions for what are called or categorized as kit cars, meaning home builds. You know, if you're familiar with the Lotus 7, there's a couple of companies that make knockoffs of the Lotus 7. And basically, you buy the chassis, you buy the parts, then you put your own engine in it and you put it together. And then you register it. And there are other examples of that. AC Cobras are one. And you know, you're allowed to do this. The state limits the number, though, of like if you're a company, if you're a manufacturer, you can't sell over so many of them. But nonetheless, you can still get away. I love the language. You can still get away with it by doing this sort of thing. And to get back to the old cars, in a way, those old cars are kind of open source because they are so interchangeable. You can take a part from this one and you can put it into that one pretty easily. In most cases, if it physically fits, it'll work. You know, that was one of the great joys when I was a kid and started working on cars, was the fun of saying, well, I wonder if I could put this in that. I wonder if I could fit that engine or this transmission or whatever the part was into that vehicle. And if you had a little bit of ingenuity and were willing to wrench a little bit, you could probably make it work. And wow, look at that. That's neat. You could do that. Now, these cars are so completely integrated with their components that you can't even replace the radio without going to the dealer, you know, and having the whole thing reflashed or in some way meshed and mated so that the computer accepts. And it's gotten so bad, you can't even pull the battery out of the thing. You know, you better not take a battery out of a modern car because it will brick the car. You know, I found out about that last year. I was given a new Dodge Hornet, their little crossover, to test drive for a week. And the second day that I had it, it wouldn't start. So I got out my multimeter to check the battery. I'd done this a zillion times in the past to see what the voltage of the battery was. And it was down to like 11 volts. And most modern cars with fuel injection won't start unless they have a certain amount of voltage. So I did what I've always done. I took it out, put it on my bench, and put it on the trickle charger. Charged it up, went to put it back in the car. The car went berserk. Lights flashing, horn honking, wouldn't start. Couldn't get it to stop. I used all my powers and all my skills. You remember from The Godfather? couldn't figure it out. I ended up calling Chrysler Engineering, Dodge Engineering, and got them on the phone. They couldn't figure it out either. We ended up having to have the thing flatbedded to a dealer to have it fixed over a battery.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the state that we are in at the moment. That's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, kit cars, I would imagine, not be for everyone. Also, I mean, there is the issue of roadworthy vehicle. What is the actual bare minimum limit that is placed on a roadworthy vehicle in the U.S.?
Well, it's highly subjective. Depends on what you consider to be roadworthy. Some people would say a car that doesn't have power windows and automatic transmission and air conditioning isn't roadworthy. But most of these kit cars, you can add all of those things to. Now, the Caterham 7, the Lotus 7 kits, that's as minimalist as it gets. It's practically a motorcycle. Speaking of which, there are some interesting things. If you go to a motorcycle store, you'll probably see these these sort of souped up four-wheelers. They're not like your typical ATV. They're very close to being a car in every way, except they're not street legal. But a lot of people are using them on the street regardless, because they've got enough power and capability to be operated on the street. And, you know, in rural areas, I live in a rural area, nobody cares. You know, even the cops don't particularly care. So you can get away with it. Another good example, there's a company called Roxor, which is an Indian company that basically makes the old Willys Jeep. You know, so they got the rights to the old Jeep, you know, the one that today is the Wrangler. But it's the simple one, like from MASH, you know, the MASH Jeep, that Jeep. You can buy it. Now, technically, it's not for public, for use on public roads, but who's going to know? It looks literally like an old Jeep, you know, and if you were to, oh, I don't know, put antique tags on it, who's going to know?
You know,
I've often
you make another good point about the noncompliance issue, because, again, it is about a culture of noncompliance. And in rural areas, I mean, I grew up in rural Alberta, where I knew a bunch of farmers whose kids were driving pickups at 12 years old. I mean, it happens. They don't care. It's not a big deal.
And it shouldn't be, because it's not a moral issue. You know, I understand, you know, this sort of reflexive, instinctive response that often comes up when I say these things. Well, what you're doing is against the law. Well, so what? You know, I mean, it was against the law back in 1850 to harbor a fugitive slave. You know, I think people should ask the question, am I doing something wrong, you know, morally speaking? And if the answer is no, well, then why not do it? You know, why should we be bound by a law just because it's the law? There were lots of laws in Stalin's Soviet Union and in Hitler's Germany. But, you know, most people are taught to feel that, you know, people who resisted those laws were heroes. You know, we should apply that same principle here.
All right, let's talk about at least one other angle that we can take on this. I'm sure you've seen recently, in recent months and years, people like Robbie Starbuck and other campaigners have been going to various companies like Harley-Davidson and others and getting them to remove their woke DEI policies and all of that from their institutional framework, etc. Just by applying the power of not even the boycott, but the threat of a boycott, or at least just drawing attention to the issue. To what extent do you think that might be a viable way to push back on this and to get companies to actually listen to these kinds of complaints?
Well, obviously it's viable. It's worked. Starbucks has done yeoman's work in that regard in getting these companies to dial it back. And thank God for that. You know, don't you miss the world where, you know, for example, a Harley Davidson was interested in selling you a motorcycle, not an ideology?
Or Jaguar. Copy nothing.
It doesn't matter whether you're on the left or the right. Look, if I go to a Harley store, I'm interested in the bike. You know, I'm not interested in what your politics are. You guys shouldn't be interested in mine. You should be interested in whether I'm able to purchase your product, and that should be the end of it. You know, work is work, and politics is politics, and the two ought to be separate, I think.
But do you think we can apply that specifically to issues like, for example, the privacy issue, or taking away some of these Toyota safety sense and other things that are taking power away from
sure, because again, it's really an ideological question. You know, it's about privacy, your right to it, my right to it. And there's something effronterous about this idea that the car I'm paying for, I have my name on the lien and the title, I'm paying for this, and yet you are somehow, like, literally, in a real sense, you know, you're sort of opening the door to my car and sitting in it and seeing whether I've been eating burritos in it or, you know, where I've been going. It's obnoxious. And enough of this already. You know, we would, I think, have more clarity about it if, let's say, the mortgage company that you have your home loan with randomly sent a guy to kind of, you know, just enter any what you think is your house whenever they feel like it to have a look around. Let me see what's going on here. You know, nobody would put up with that. So why do we put up with that with our cars?
This is the question. Why do we put up with this? Well, again, I think a lot of people just feel, well, it's the law and we just got to go along with it. And it's what they're selling. What can we do?
Well, I think with cars, a lot of people who are not familiar with these issues, which is probably most people, don't even know. A lot of people that I talk to are absolutely shocked when they find out that every single new car has cameras and microphones built into it to listen in on what's going on in the car and potentially to even visually record what's going on in the car. The New York Times did a piece a couple of weeks back where they disclosed the degree to which some of these car companies are mining your data. You know, from the touchscreen, you enter, you want to go to a restaurant. So now the you know, somebody knows that you like Chuck E. Cheese or whatever it is, and that data is being sold. You're not getting even a check or a discount coupon in the mail, and somebody else is making money, you know, off of your personal preferences, and it just shouldn't happen.
And then, of course, always law enforcement authorities can always claim that data and build a profile on you if they so choose.
Oh yeah, the insurance mafia, and I always use that term because that's what they are. They're a mafia. They, you know, they use the coercive power of the state to compel you to buy their services. So they're a mafia. It's not a free market thing. They are champing at the bit to have access to data about things like whether you're driving over the speed limit, you know, whether you accelerated to, and they'll put it aggressively, you know, whether you brake too aggressively. And in fact, it's already being done on a voluntary basis. You've probably seen these ads. Progressive is one of the companies that does this. You know, oh, just let us put our little dongle thing into your OBD port, you know, and you'll get a safe driving discount. I know of nobody who's gotten the safe driving discount. What happens is, you know, normal driving, you know, you jerk the wheel because a kid ran in the road, or, you know, you're pulling out from an intersection. Oh my gosh, there's a semi coming. So you floor it to, you know, put some distance. You get something in the mail. You know, we noticed that your driving was aggressive. And so we're increasing your premium by so many dollars. Ask a commercial driver, you know, commercial drivers who drive big trucks.
Yeah.
You know, they are monitored to the nth degree. And that's why people complain about when they're on the highway, the semi, he's in the left lane and he's, you know, he's doing 67 and the speed limit's 65. That's because if he goes any faster, he's going to lose his job.
Yep, exactly right. It's, yeah. And this is the thing that I think people always understand when it is pointed out to them, but it is always contextual. And yes, there are times when, yes, you have to drive in ways that otherwise would be illegal or whatever, just because of the flow of traffic or what have you, in order to avoid the accident rather than to cause it. So anyway, yeah, it's a ridiculous mess. And I think a large part of this mess is because, as you say, that collusion between government and regulators who love to meddle as much as they can in order to make you part of their captive market. So I think an incredibly important part of this is just awareness of the issue is an incredibly important step to this, because as you say, so few people are really aware of how much data and privacy and security is being forfeited to these companies. So I think we just need to get people aware of this and then starting to actually flex their muscles, make some demand.
It's happening. I think there, if you follow these issues, and I'm speaking generally, there always seems to be sort of a lag. Mm. You know, there's sort of a small cohort who initially smells a rat, sees it, they start to talk about it. But by and large, most people don't. There are all sorts of examples about this. You know, for example, the safe and effective vaccines that are now acknowledged to be neither safe nor particularly effective. You know, that's common knowledge now. It's becoming common knowledge that these cars are basically mobile spy machines that are just, you know, keeping track of you at all times. The recent business with that guy who drove the Cybertruck to Trump's hotel in Vegas and detonated it, almost immediately they were able to figure out where this guy had been, where he'd started, where he'd stopped, all of that. And, you know, people are going, that's interesting. Well, I guess if they can do it for him, they can do it for me too, right? And of course they can. And, you know, there's another example, and this isn't just Tesla. You know, I like to hit the Tesla pinata, but it's not just him. It's the entire car industry. There was a hurricane that came through Florida or Texas. I can't remember which one it was a couple of years ago. And Elon Musk, Tesla, sent out an update that allowed the vehicles to be driven a little bit farther in order, you know, benevolently. We're going to give you a little bit more range to let you escape the hurricane. Now, implicit in that, it occurs to me, if they can give you more range, they can give you less, right?
They were giving them less. They decided to give them more. That's crazy.
Right. So imagine that, you know, it's kind of like, this is kind of a funny, humorous way to think about it. You know, imagine you get up in the middle of the night for a bathroom break and you go into the bathroom, but somebody moved the toilet to a different part of the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely insanity. All right. Yeah. Okay. There's so many aspects to this. As I say, I hope at least conversations like this one get more people thinking along these lines, because I really do think more people aware of this issue will start to move the needle in a different direction. But anything else you want to say on this topic before we wind up this conversation?
Yeah, you know, I think we as Americans have taken cars and our freedom to use them the way we wish to for granted for far too long. And that has been systematically eroded now for at least 50 years. It's picked up speed, it's accelerated, and it's getting worse. And if we lose that, I think in a very real way, we're going to lose a lot of the freedom that we also once took for granted in this country. So I encourage people to give it some thought and to push back against it, even just by saying, no, I'm not going to go along with it. I'm going to find a way around it.
All right. And once again, for people who are just being introduced to your work, tell us about epautos.com and the types of stuff you cover there on a regular basis.
Oh, sure. You know, I call it the web's best libertarian gearhead site because, to my knowledge, it's the only libertarian gearhead site. So, you know, we combine just your straightforward stuff about cars that's of interest to people who are motorheads, and also political things as they relate to cars, and also generally broader philosophical conversations, too. You know, I've got something about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency up now that doesn't per se have anything to do with cars, but there's so much overlap with all of these issues that I like to kind of go there when I think it's worth going there.
Yes, excellent. Well, I've got you on my radar. I'm reading your articles. I hope people will do likewise. We'll direct them there. ericpetersautos.com, epautos.com. We'll get you to his website, and I think we'll leave the conversation there, but obviously there will be many more developments on this in the future, so I hope we can talk again. Eric Peters, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, James. Appreciate it.